You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of March 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bounds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu signing a deal today for a coalition with rival parties, Monocle's Joseph Dana ticks off his top five things that Bibi should do in the first 100 days. And we'll discuss the health of the German news weekly market and the relaunch of Stern with that magazine's top chief.
Sales are going extremely up, and the reactions from readers and from advertising clients are pretty good. So it's too early to really say it's a success, but it seems to be like a success.
A little later on, we'll head to Austria too, to the Diagonale Film Festival, to see which films are taking in the awards. Here's one.
If you're happy and you know it, clap your fat. If you're happy and you know it, clap your fat. If you're happy and you know it.
That's an edifying clip. And then we'll continue our quest to meet every possible neighbour next to our bureau around the world. Here's one near our Hong Kong office.
I have grown into this place a lot. It's another world, basically. It doesn't look like Hong Kong at all. That's what I like, is the old part of Hong Kong, which preserves its own characteristic.
And speaking of Hong Kong, our outgoing New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears, is soon off to that city to take the reins of their bureau there. But before she returns to New York, she recounts the things she hopes change in that city.
New York, it's over between us, at least for now. The next time I arrive in the city, would it be possible to be welcomed back by a friendly face at immigration? Instilling a little charm into Team Homeland Security doesn't mean they'll be any less effective at protecting US borders.
More of that, plus we'll get an update from day two of the EU summit in Brussels and some great tunes too, including a new Bowie. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, it's news time with Paul Osborne.
France and Britain have restated their calls for further action to support Syria's rebels. It's exactly 2 years since the start of the uprising against Bashar al-Assad's regime. 70,000 people have died and more than a million have fled the violence. Other EU nations don't support calls from Paris and London to lift the ban on arming the rebels. The UN's High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, has been in Lebanon, where he's warned the crisis in Syria could inflame tensions across the region.
The Syrian conflict is more than a humanitarian tragedy. The Syrian conflict became a meaningful threat to regional and global peace and security. There is a real risk of seeing the Syrian conflict spilling over.
Almost 2 months after elections, Israel finally has a new government. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has signed a coalition agreement with two other groups. One is a centrist party, the other a pro-settler group. The agreement comes the day before the legal deadline for forming a government. The Vatican is dismissing allegations of Pope Francis failed to speak out about human rights abuses in Argentina, saying it's part of a left-wing plot against the Church. He's accused of not protecting two Jesuit priests arrested by Argentina's military dictatorship in the 1970s, when he was the head of the country's Jesuit order. But officials in Rome say there's no evidence against the Pope. Father Tom Rosica is a Vatican spokesman.
The accusations belong in a certain way to a type of a historical sociological criticism of the period, of the dictatorial period, and also they reveal left-wing elements, anti-clerical elements that are used to attack the Church. They must be firmly and clearly denied.
North Korea has accused the United States of being behind attacks on its internet servers. The websites of the country's airline and main newspaper have often been unavailable in recent days. Pyongyang says it's been timed to coincide with joint US and South Korean military exercises. Doctors treating the autistic director of the Bolshoi Ballet say he may recover enough sight to return to work. Sergei Filin had acid thrown in his face in an attack in Moscow in January. A dancer at the ballet is among three people who've been charged. Mr. Filin has had surgery in Germany and will need further treatment in the coming months. Work on a new underground railway line in London has unearthed what could be a mass grave from the mid-14th century. It's thought to be a burial ground from the time of the Black Death, which killed around 200 million people. So far, 13 sets of remains have been found. Jay Carver, the archaeologist for the Crossrail project, says the site on the edge of what's now London's financial district could be huge.
So we're just on one small corner of a large area which is known as Charterhouse Square, and it's quite likely, we suspect, that there are hundreds more burials below the square.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul. It's 18:05 here in London, and you're tuned in to Midori House. All right, it's Midori House coming to you live from Studio One here at Monocle 24. And today, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's Prime Minister, finally signed a deal with rival parties to form a coalition government. The deal was weeks in the making after a lengthy negotiation period, and the coalition created is not without its critics. For one, it's given the most influence to Jewish settlers in the West Bank and the secular bourgeoisie of Tel Aviv, meaning that the ultra-Orthodox are on the outs along with the Palestinians. Well, we thought we'd ask our Jerusalem correspondent, Joseph Dana, what his top five tips would be if he had the ear of Benjamin Netanyahu. So what should Bibi do in the next 100 days? Joseph joins us now on the line. Hi, Joseph. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening. Great to be here.
Now, you've kind of given us a few recommendations if you had the ear of Mr. Netanyahu. First up, you've advised him to put aside partisan bickering and fighting, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, anyone that's watched the recent news coming out of Israel over the last couple of months has seen that this coalition that has just now been announced has really been quite messy in the making. And so Netanyahu has emerged much weaker than he's ever been in his very long political career in Israel. And he has to kind of read the writing on the wall. He has to understand that there are a number of new political forces at play in Israeli politics, a number of new political personalities like Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, the two kind of kingmakers from the last election, that are challenging his style of management of the Israeli state. And moving forward, he has to kind of put aside his differences to ensure that he remains relevant in what is a very kind of murky picture, as it were.
And so Netanyahu's leadership took a bit of a hit in this election, obviously. Does he have to make friends with people that he naturally wouldn't side with? Or do you think he's going to learn something from having to sort of go bipartisan?
Well, Netanyahu, I mean, many things can be said about Netanyahu as a politician, but he is definitely a very savvy politician. And so what he really needs to do is kind of focus on the Israeli heartland, if I can use that term. The Israelis that are living in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Haifa, the middle class that has really suffered as Israel's become an incredibly expensive country to live in. And he needs to address the hearts and minds of these voters. You know, recently there was an initiative in Israel that kind of demonopolized the cell phone market, which used to be incredibly expensive to get a cell phone, and a couple of very savvy politicians in the Israeli parliament pushed through some legislation and made it much cheaper. And so he's going to have to focus on something like that to give a little bit back to the middle class that has in recent years become very vocal against his style of specifically economic leadership.
And just staying on the Israeli heartland, as you call it, for a minute, Haifa, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, are the burghers of these cities, are they natural Likud supporters? Are they Netanyahu's men and women?
Well, we're seeing a drift away from this. You know, during the kind of violence of the Second Intifada, Likud and its very kind of hardline politics vis-a-vis the Palestinians did experience a lot of growth and popularity inside of Israel. But this last election has demonstrated that Israelis went to the polls with domestic issues in mind. They went to the polls thinking about high taxes in Tel Aviv and you know, the incredible cost of living in Israel in general. And so we see, you know, Yair Lapid from the Yesh Atid party, you know, becoming a dominant force in Israeli politics on, you know, a platform of kind of democratic and restructuring of the domestic arena. And so Netanyahu is going to have to read the writing on the wall, as I noted, and kind of emulate some of these positions.
Now, another prescription you've made for Netanyahu is being clear about how to move forward with the Palestinians. Barack Obama's visit to Israel next week presumably is a good opportunity to set out his stall, right?
Right. Well, this is very much one of the kind of long shots in my recommendations for not just Netanyahu, but for Israel in general, is that I think we're seeing increasingly an international community, and especially, the United States, kind of wanting to see some new thinking from the Israelis. You know, we hear about the fact that settlements on the West Bank are increasing. The Americans have made it very clear that this is something that they don't want. And yet Israel has been insistent on going back to a negotiations table, which has never really been fruitful vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And so we have the American president coming here next week for the first time in his presidency. And this would be a perfect time for the Israelis to kind of surprise the international community and maybe come up with a new way of breaking the deadlock, maybe even accepting a limited settlement freeze or something that will demonstrate a willingness to get out of the status quo that is hanging over Israel-Palestine. But like I said, this is very much a long shot because Israelis are so concerned with kind of domestic issues and domestic politics at this point.
Okay, and we've got an age-old question next. This is the ultra-Orthodox military thing. Can you talk us through that, Joseph?
Right. We've been talking about this a little bit on Monocle this week. Drafting the ultra-Orthodox into the Israeli military, which the Israeli military is the kind of cultural maker, the barometer of Israeli society, has been a very big issue in this last election. We're talking about 10% of the population that does not go to the army and that exists on a lot of kind of state benefits and doesn't really contribute to the workforce. And so this has become a huge issue of the coalition. Naftali Bennett specifically and Yair Lapid have said that drafting the ultra-Orthodox is going to be one of their main political objectives. And yet, we have to kind of step back and understand that you don't just draft 10% of the population that's never been in the army. It doesn't happen overnight. You know, you're not going to just kind of move 500,000 settlers out of the West Bank tomorrow. And so there has to be a bit of a diffusion of this issue, a bit of cooling down in which the parties understand that the politicians do recognize the incredible desire of Israelis to have this issue resolved, to have ultra-Orthodox join the military, but it's not going to happen overnight. And so this will require a bit of diplomacy, which hopefully Netanyahu and other politicians in the new coalition will be able to muster in order to kind of maintain somewhat of a cohesion in Israeli society as a whole.
Okay, and finally, Joseph, I wanted to talk about the fact that Israel's obviously always in the middle of this cauldron in the Middle East, none more so at the moment, with regimes falling, changing, reputations being made across the Middle East and world. One of Benjamin Netanyahu's jobs, presumably, is to counsel his public, I guess, on the changing world around him, and that there won't be any political certainties, presumably.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the most breathtaking aspects of this last election kind of round in Israel, especially for the Western perspective, is that Syria during the next Israeli parliament will probably change dramatically. You know, Assad will probably go. And the complexion of the Middle East is in a period of rapid transformation. And yet Israelis, you know, are going to the polls about domestic issues. And so there's a bit of a gulf between the rhetoric and the reality of how Israelis are understanding their position in this changing Middle East. And I think that the role of the next government, and Netanyahu specifically, is going to have to be to kind of articulate the fact that Israel is not in a very stable neighborhood, as it were, and that, you know, either an outbreak of violence with Hezbollah in the north or renewed kind of violence with Hamas in Gaza or some kind of dramatic change is on the horizon. And so while the domestic issues are very, very important, you know, for any country, Israel is in a special situation. And so Israelis will have to kind of ready themselves for dramatic transformations. And so, you know, there's going to have to be some real kind of frank talk about what actually is on the horizon and how that is going to affect Israeli society.
All right, Joseph, thank you very much for the time being. I'm sure we'll check in with you during Obama's visit next week. That was Joseph Dana, Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent. Up next, we're going to play a new track from David Bowie, and we're going to be investigating the News Weekly Market in Germany. All right, and here it is on the topic of training your guns at men in the sand, possibly in Israel. This is new from David Bowie from the album The Next Day. This is I'd Rather Be High. Better cut than nothing at all. That was I'd Rather Be High, new from David Bowie. And this is Monocle 24.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide on Monocle.com.
All right, it's 1818 here in Studio One in London. I'm Robert Bound. This is Midori House. And in case you thought all media markets were the same, especially amongst the world's biggest economies, then it's curious to see what a difference a week makes. Just as Time Warner announced it's set to offload its flagship news magazine, German publisher Gruner & Jahr has thrown millions of euros at relaunching Stern, the well and truly iconic Hamburg-based newsweekly. In a moment, we'll be speaking to editor Dominic Wichmann about his relaunch. But first, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, scoured the streets to track down a copy in Berlin.
When was the last time you went in search of a weekly news magazine only to find it sold out? How often have you had to go to four different kiosks to get your hands on a copy of a magazine that represents a sector in decline? And what kind of publisher would pour money into relaunching a news magazine at a time when others are looking to offload theirs? In most other markets, all of this might sound like a media tale from the 1970s, but most other markets aren't Germany, and none have a weekly news magazine landscape as competitive as Germany's. Yesterday, the venerable and occasionally controversial Stern, remember those Hitler diaries? Relaunched with a slightly tweaked cover, a bit of new typography, and a 1 euro cover price. In most markets, it's unlikely this would make much of a difference, but it took four attempts to get my hands on a copy of Chefredakteur Dominik Wichmann's Neue Stern and its Ich liebe Gott und eine Frau cover. At first glance, it's much like old Stern, a trusty red box with a white star, bold cover lines, and a somewhat friendlier, cozier Stern logo. Inside, there's an emphasis on big photojournalism, a healthy dose of Sebastio Salgado, lots of domestic news coverage, a cozy little photo of a bear, and an interview with Mikhail Gorbachev. Unlike most other newsweeklies, it's also big. Not as big as it used to be, but it still weighs in at a healthy 164 pages, plus supplements. Wichmann is something of a star on the German editorial scene, and while I was looking for a little more cheekiness and perhaps a bit more wit when I flipped through the issue, I also liked the fact that it was still Stern, and it hadn't thrown things out for the sake of it. Then again, this is a weekly, in a country with a heavy history, and Wichmann is perhaps just warming the German audience up. If anyone's in doubt about the future of the newsweekly, the Federal Republic is a good example of a market that still sees value in big journalism and is prepared to invest in a bit of editorial reinvention, even if it means taking a hit on the cover price. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Tyler Brulé.
And we'll be crossing over to speak to Tyler live in Berlin in a little while, but a little earlier on, I spoke to Stern's new editor-in-chief, Dominik Wichmann, about the relaunch. Now, your advertising campaign said that March the 14th, that was yesterday, is a holiday. Does the Stern relaunch give you a bit of a hangover? How are you today?
Well, I'm fine. We had a little party yesterday night, so I have a hangover. But no, actually, I'm doing fine because we just got the first numbers from the newsstands, and they're pretty nice.
Oh, good. So this, you can see the kind of proof already of the redesign and the relaunch in the figures that you got in today, right?
Well, More or less. I mean, we were working on that for more than a year, and we did a lot of marketing, and we did a lot of advertising campaign in advance, and we also sold the first issue for just €1, so normally it's €3.50, so it's an argument to buy the magazine. However, the sales are going extremely up, and the reactions from readers and from advertising clients are pretty good. So it's too early to really say it's a success, but it seems to be like a success.
Cool. And the relaunch has taken its effect on the front cover of the magazine, on the masthead, and the logo Stern itself has been altered, as well as some of the page furniture inside. And there's some new sections. Maybe you can take us through some of these new sections, Dominik. Diese Woche, right through to the end of the magazine.
We started about a year ago, and I hired a guy from New York you might know, Luke Heyman from the Pentagram Agency, who helped us a lot. Luke Heyman was the art director of the New York magazine, and he did the relaunch of Time magazine and Atlantic. And with Luke and his team, Shigeto, and other guys here from Hamburg, we formed a little team, and under the name of North Wind, that was the code word, we worked a lot, first of all, on the brand's DNA, what Stern stands for. It's a very established news magazine brand in Germany. However, it got a bit dusty in the last years. So first of all, we dived into the archives and had a look on what is Stern actually and what makes it special. And then we focused a lot on the second half of the 80s and tried to do kind of the Mini concept, from the Mini Cooper to the new Mini, in other words, to reestablish and to revitalize the brand in a way. So first of all, we divided the architecture of the magazine into three parts, and Stern's publishing day is Thursday. So we said Thursday is kind of a hybrid insofar as it's still lean forward, it's still in the week, it's still in a day where you are in the middle of your work life and all this kind of stuff. But on the other hand, it's leaned back already because the day before the weekend comes, and the weekend is identified with all these leisure topics and outdoor and shopping and all this kind of stuff. So in other words, the architecture of the magazine, I think, should reflect this. And therefore, we divided the magazine into three parts. The first part is called This Week, and it focuses very much on the topics of the week and all these topics which are related to the work life. And the last part of the magazine is called Journal. And this part focuses a lot on the topics which are related to the weekend. And in the middle, there's a very, very large part we call the heart of the magazine. And in this part, basically, we focus like a monthly magazine on weekly topics. So large portfolios, photography portfolios, reportage, interviews, all this kind of stuff. This is more or less the architecture of the magazine.
Okay, and you're lucky to kind of come out on a Thursday if you're focusing more on Journal than Diese Woche, more on the kind of lifestyle features than the news. Have you changed the balance of news and lifestyle stuff, Dominik? A lot of British magazines seem to carry a lot more pictures of handbags and headphones and accessories these days, maybe than kind of stories about Syria. How have you guys managed to balance it?
No, we didn't really change the balance. The range of topics is still the same. We didn't want to change that. I mean, especially in Germany, it's very risky to focus too much on lifestyle because lifestyle is identified as not serious, as kind of superficial and all this kind of stuff. So we didn't do that. But the major thing what we did is we said, let's do a brand and not a magazine. In other words, let's focus on these parameters which shape a brand and not necessarily a magazine. In other words, there is a magazine is just the printed version of the magazine. It's just one part of the brand. Other parts is the web, is the whole smart area, the e-magazines, events, all these kind of stuff are part of the brand. So what we did is basically we did not try to discriminate our brand from other brands through focusing on specific topics or not focusing on other topics. But what we did instead of that, we tried to define a certain way of how we deal with these topics. In other words, Stern over the last years became a little cynical, and we tried to have a more friendly approach towards the world and not the cynical, ironic approach, more down to earth. And that was the major shift, actually, and that works pretty well.
And I wanted to ask you more generally about the world of German news weeklies. It's an unprecedentedly healthy market. I think sales of Stern and Der Spiegel, I guess your most relevant competitor, have kind of fallen a little bit, but nothing in comparison to a lot of the newspapers across the rest of the world and in Germany as well. Why do Germans love news weeklies so much?
Honestly?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know.
That's a €64 million question, Dominic.
No, I'm glad that it's this way. But, you know, the funny story, when we arrived in New York and had the first talks with Luke Heyman, he grabbed the magazine and it's so thick, and he said, "When did you publish that?" And I said, "Well, last week." And he said, "Are you kidding? I mean, it feels like 5 years ago." So in other words, the German market, that's right, is still relatively healthy. However, in the last year, we had also like 12% drop, and the first month of this year were horrible. But still, yes, you're right. News magazines, weeklies are still earning a lot of money in Germany, yet the numbers are going down. And if we don't change it, we were afraid to end up like Newsweek ended up.
Well, for the time being, Dominic Wickman, best of luck with the rest of Stern. I guess you've got a good week, a nice new Pope slipstream to riff off next week. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And that was me speaking to Dominic Wickman from Hamburg earlier on. And now we have our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, on the line from Berlin. Hi, Tyler.
Herr Baum, guten Abend.
Guten Abend. I wanted to ask you, Dominic, there in that little package, was talking about trying to make Stern a friendly place to be. Do you feel, having cracked the spine or exercised the staples on it this afternoon, do you feel like you were in the arms of a buddy?
Well, as I mentioned in the piece, there, you know, every friendly issue does need a white cozy bear, especially as a spread. So I think they've definitely conquered the cozy, friendlier factor. But that is one of the curious things. They've slightly tweaked their, I think, what it, you know, it's so classic and very strong, the not the Stern Star logo, but the actual word mark itself. And they've made that a little bit friendlier. Now, it hasn't sort of gone down, you know, the route of Comic Sans, but and, you know, it still feels like Stern. But I think to a somewhat trained eye in graphic design, you just say, okay, they have gone for a friendliness factor.
The stack is coming from Berlin tomorrow, so presumably you've, as ever, I guess, kind of released yourself back to the hotel with a stack of media under your arm, Tyler. But I wanted to ask you the question that Dominic Wickman couldn't answer, amusingly enough. Why do Germans like Newsweekly so much? I think there's a bit of peer pressure involved, isn't it? You're either a Stern person or a Spiegel person.
Yeah, or you might be, laterally, you might be a Focus person.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, the big fight on the German newsstand is between Der Spiegel and Stern. Berta's Focus was a bit of a light cover. Nevertheless, you know, there are three very strong, very healthy newsweeklies. And I think, you know, part of this has to do with, these are titles that all came along after the war. These were, you know, magazines which really are helping Germany sort of figure out its identity, its way in the world. And I think that, you know, as part of that, they've always, you know, played a role in this very vigorous dialogue at a time right now, you know, as we know, Rob, that, you know, Germans are now trying to, you know, to figure out. They haven't done anything wrong economically. The country is doing reasonably well. But can you still be proud to be a German? And, you know, there's all this sort of ongoing soul-searching as well. And I think these magazines, as much as they're covering the world, they're also spending a lot of time, I think, you know, digging very deep into the German soul. So I think they play sort of the role of almost, you know, going to the therapist once a week as well.
And just finally, as we said, and as you said in your report, the price drop thing is interesting. It's gone from €3.50, I think, to a euro. I don't know how long that lasts, maybe just a week. What are the perils of that, do you think?
Well, of course, you could have this incredible spike. And then, of course, when Dominic and his team then go and visit advertising agencies and you talk about cynical, everyone will say, well, you know, there you go. It was only a price game, and all of your great art direction and all of your great editorial and whatever changes you've made, you know, really don't amount to much, and your magazine is still in decline. Clearly, from this first issue, though, advertisers do like it, as he said. A big glossy spread from Mercedes-Benz, which was quite new. I'd never seen them do something like that. And yeah, a pretty good roster of advertising. I think what's one of the curious things he said, though, was about that German relationship to when you move to lifestyle too much. And I think, as you noted, you know, that's really been a trick of I would say sort of the English language newsstand, whether it's sort of the FT with How to Spend It, etc. Everyone has moved into the land of headphones and handbags, as you rightly said, and German, you know, titles have resisted it, and I think it could be for the better for this market.
Cool. Well, for the time being, Tyler, thank you very much. And don't forget to tune in to tomorrow's edition of The Stack, which will be a kind of something of a German News Weekly and German media special. That's on tomorrow. In the next half hour of the show, we'll get an update from the EU summit in Brussels. We'll head to a film festival in Austria, and we'll continue our quest to meet as many neighbours surrounding our HQ and bureau as humanly possible. Today, we're in Hong Kong.
I've grown into this place a lot. It's another world, basically. It doesn't look like Hong Kong at all. That's what I like, is the old part of Hong Kong, which preserves its own characteristic.
But before that, of course, it is news time with Paul Osborne.
EU governments have refused calls from France and Britain to lift the ban on arming Syria's rebels. It was the subject of a meeting in Brussels exactly 2 years after the start of the uprising against the Assad regime. Both Paris and London want further action to support rebel groups in Syria. Almost 2 months after elections in Israel, the country has a new government. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has signed a coalition agreement with two other groups, one a centrist party, the other a pro-settler group. The Vatican's dismissed allegations that Pope Francis failed to speak out against human rights abuses in Argentina, describing it as part of a left-wing plot against the Church. He's been accused of failing to protect two Jesuit priests who were arrested by the Argentinian military dictatorship in the 70s when he was the head of the country's Jesuit order. Doctors treating the artistic director of the Bolshoi Ballet say he may recover enough sight to return to work. In January, Sergei Filin had acid thrown in his face near his home in Moscow. A dancer at the ballet is among three people who've been charged. He's now in Germany, where he's had surgery. And work on a new underground railway line in London's unearthed what may be a mass grave dating back to the 14th century. So far, 13 sets of remains have been found, but it's thought to be a burial ground from the time of the Black Death, which killed a total of 200 million people. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
All right, 1833 here in London. It's Midori House. I'm Robert Bound. Brussels has been playing host to yet another EU summit this week. At least they didn't blow the travel budget this time by staying at home. But was this week's meeting a chorus of approval or a nest of vipers? It was a big week for the UK and France trying to get their plan to arm the Syrian rebels through against a backdrop of tricky financial chess as ever. Joining us now is Brussels-based journalist Charlotte McDonald-Gibson to give us a bit of a lowdown. Charlotte, welcome to Midori House.
Hi there.
So what happened here with France and Britain wanting to get this arms embargo for the Syrian rebels dropped? They weren't successful.
They weren't. First of all, it was very unexpected. No one had Syria on the agenda for these talks. Then all of a sudden, François Hollande coming into the talks yesterday, he straight away said, I want the EU to lift this arms embargo. Now, this arms embargo dates back to 2001 when the uprising began, and it said that the European Union can't supply arms to either the rebels or to the regime. Now, the Brits had really pushed, and William Hague pushed to soften this in February, which to allow non-lethal aid, such as bulletproof vests, armoured vehicles, to be channeled to the rebels. So everyone thought the British and the French were happy with this, and they were quite surprised when François Hollande and David Cameron came in yesterday saying they wanted to have this amended so that they could, if they wanted to, supply arms to the rebels. Now, alas, their push seems to have failed today, as all the other European Union nations didn't seem keen to support this plan. Angela Merkel in particular came out saying she was afraid this might fan the flames of the conflict, especially as Iran and Russia are seen to be arming the regime. So there's a worry there that it could spark a fresh arms race in the region.
And I wondered also just on Hollande and Cameron's suddenly sort of breaking with tradition. This is obviously normally an economically based meeting at this time of year. I wonder what the atmosphere might have been like when they suddenly rock up with a new proposal like that.
Yes, exactly. There appeared to have been no prior warning. It wasn't as if it was just journalists or the general public who were surprised by this. There was very much the sense there that the diplomats had not necessarily been given the heads up either. So this might explain why there was such a frosty reception to the proposals when they were put forward. Now they're saying that they're going to discuss these proposals again next week when EU foreign ministers meet in Ireland. So maybe then they'll make some more progress when people have had a bit of time to absorb this new push, these new ideas.
And as we said, normally this is an economically focused meeting in Brussels. One of the key headlines, other than the sort of Syrian intervention, was about policies that favouring growth rather than just banging the austerity gavel the whole time.
Yes, that's right. Going into the meeting, that was very much what the different countries were talking about, whether or not these austerity measures have helped drag Europe back to prosperity or whether they're condemning millions to unemployment and hardship. It looks like there wasn't any huge disagreement between the various sides at this summit. The communique, the conclusions that were published late last night are very similar to the draft conclusions we saw last week, which tends to demonstrate there wasn't a huge locking of horns. The conclusions are very sort of Brussels speak, but they do have a certain sentences which talk about short-term targeted measures to boost growth. And these are seen as somewhat softening the language against a very harsh austerity-only line. But it doesn't look like the argument's going away. I mean, just today, the former Italian Premier Roman Prodi gave an interview saying that austerity had gone too far. So the debate is still very much out there. And I think what people are waiting for are the German elections later this year, when Angela Merkel has to a certain extent, speak to her electorate, which are very pro-austerity because they don't want German tax dollars propping up struggling Eurozone members. So the feeling is this debate is going to be put on ice somewhat until later on this year.
And I wanted also to ask you about Cyprus, which I think was not necessarily on the agenda, but came up. Cyprus is on the brink of bankruptcy, but people have got a bit of a vested interest in propping it up or not, right?
Well, yes, Cyprus is being discussed as we speak. It is actually an extraordinary meeting of the Eurozone finance ministers tonight, which came after the main summit. There's differing signals coming out. Cyprus basically is said it's going to go broke by the end of the month unless it gets some money. Now, it was initially after about 17 billion euros, which compared to the other Eurozone nations who've been bailed out, it's pretty small fry. I mean, Greece got approximately 240 billion euros. But yes, there are some interesting issues with Cyprus. Certain countries have expressed concern that the money going into Cyprus is Russian money, and there have been allegations that Cyprus is a center for money laundering. So there's a lot of resistance for any bailout to be given to Cyprus, which could possibly then end up benefiting criminals, essentially. So that's one of the arguments that's going on now, although the Cypriot government has promised to do a review of their sector to make sure this isn't an issue. So people are waiting for an outcome on that, amongst other things. So we should get some indication later on tonight of whether or not Cyprus is going to get this money or not.
All right. Thanks, Charlotte. Nice speaking to you. That was Brussels-based journalist Charlotte McDonald-Gibson with the latest from day two of that EU summit. And you're tuned in to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a song and some Austrian flicks. Stay tuned.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Berlin has long been a magnet for artists. As the city continues to evolve, Monocle Films explores how galleries and artists are being influenced by Berlin's complex presence.
One of the reasons that I'm in Berlin, and which is intriguing for me, is that the history is here. It's not necessarily in these bricks and mortar. It's somehow in this atmosphere. One of the great things with Berlin is it takes time to do things. Berlin is slow enough for art to happen.
Art in Berlin, a film about ghosts of the past with a view to the future, on monocle.com.
What a beautiful promo that was about the about art in Berlin. I could listen to that for the rest of the afternoon, but we're not going to. We're going to have a new song. This was reviewed in the current issue of Monocle magazine. They're from Sweden. The record is a great one. It's called Riding the Waves. From it is this beautifully, it's got a beautiful bridge in it. It's called The Evil Coast. See, the spirit of Aha is still alive and well in Scandinavia. That was the Merry Onettes from Sweden from the new album Riding the Waves. That was The Evil Coast. And you're tuned in at 18:45 to Midori House. It's 19:45 in Graz in Austria, where we're heading now, where the Diagonale Film Festival is on. It's the main platform for Austrian film. And we've got the festival's director, Barbara Pichler, on the line to talk to us. Barbara, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you. Now, Austrian film, possibly most people probably think of Michael Haneke as the greatest exponent of Austrian film. Obviously had a good year at the Oscars again this year. But what else should we know? What is Diagonale pushing this year?
I think there's actually quite a lot to know. As usual, there's not only the one person. But Austria, I think, is quite an interesting country because it is really small, but we do have a very lively and diverse film landscape. And this year, apart from Michael Haneke and Ulrich Seidel, who maybe is the other big name on the international landscape, there are a lot of young filmmakers that are pretty interesting. I think there are some really interesting debut films. Some of them had already had their international debuts at festivals like Sundance and Rotterdam and won prizes there. So that's quite an exciting time now. I will name some names so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, there are a couple of films that you queued up for us. Paradies Hoffnung was something that...
That was our opening film, which is the last part of Ulrich Seidel's trilogy. So he's the other big name, but I think that's a really special film, and the other two parts of the trilogy have premiered and won prizes at A festivals all over. And
I think we're going to have a little clip of that, Barbara. Sorry to cut you off, so that our listeners can get a taste of Paradies Hoffnung. Here is a little clip from it.
If you're happy and you know it, clap your fat. If you're happy and you know it, clap your fat. If you're happy and you know it.
Oh, ich mag Ulf seine Augen, wie steppert. Die sind so schön. Was hat er denn für Augenfarbe? Blau, so richtig himmelblau, das ist so schön.
And that was a clip from Paradies Hoffnung. Barbara, talk us through that. That sounds like a documentary, but I might be wrong.
Actually, you are quite right, because that's Ulrich Seidel's very specific style. He sort of mixes a very... of course, fictitious storyline with documentary elements, and I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but you could call it authentic fiction. He also works with professional actors and just young girls who do their first, who had their first acting experience in the film. So that's also quite an interesting tension between the acting styles in there. So you're not too far off with calling it a kind of documentary approach.
I also wanted to play the trailer for Soldata Janet. This is something else that I know you wanted to talk about, Barbara. We'll play the trailer for that and then we'll have a quick chat.
Das Kleid ist ein Kunstwerk. Das Kleid macht sie.
Ein bisschen kurz, oder?
Das Kleid macht ihnen Beine. Das ist ein Kleid, das man nicht nur trägt, das ist ein Kleid, über das man spricht.
Und das ist rot?
It's the power of being deeply moved by beautiful objects.
And that was a clip from Soldata Janet. Barbara, talk us through that one. That's been another favourite of yours at the Diagonale.
Actually, that's a real favourite of mine. And that was one of the internationally acclaimed young filmmakers I was speaking of before. He's the one who had his world premiere at Sundance and then went on to Rotterdam and won a Tiger Award. So already very prestigious festival events with this film. I really like this film because he has a very individual style. And I especially like the way he works because he does work from a script, but also there's a lot of improvising, a lot of working on the scenes with the actors. So he basically takes what the actors give him as a present and works it into the film. And there's a lot of openness and room for your own associations within the film. I really love his work, actually.
And before we go, just quickly, maybe you can tell us the dates of Diagonale how long the festival's got to run.
It's actually, we have a week and we're running till Sunday, so we're on our last legs, basically. And our award ceremony is already Saturday evening, so we're almost at the end, or at least we're in the last part of the festival already. So almost all of the big premieres are behind us. Tonight are the last big premieres, and then we're waiting for the jurors to decide on the award.
Cool. Well, while we wait to hand out the gongs, for the time being, Barbara Fickler, director of the Diagonale Film Festival in Graz, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to meet some of the neighbours near our Hong Kong bureau.
The idea of the whole shop is selling affordable artwork, which is also decorative and collectible at the same time. This is my idea because at the beginning I worked in different galleries before and I felt that a lot of stuff is actually for display or for auctions or people treating it as shares, like as a market. So I thought it would be a great idea if you could purchase a piece of artwork and put it at your home at the same time. I think that's the idea behind the whole shop. It's kind of like a personal thing as well. I think everyone wants to be slightly different, but not too much. If you know what I mean, it's kind of a weird explanation. Basically, I just found this premises by chance. I was walking around the area and really like it. And then this was on lease and I thought I might give it a go because I was shop hunting at the time. I've been looking at like Shangwan, that kind of area, but it's just not the kind of stuff I'm looking for. I like because I could actually hear the birds singing. I found this shop in November and we opened in January. 2-3 months old, yeah. I studied printmaking at uni and then I moved to marketing. And then I just realized I would like to stay in the art field. So I moved back to the art field. I'm a coffee lover. So I always think like it's a good idea to have a coffee bar where people can look at art and have a coffee at the same time. Do not necessarily have to buy anything of me, but it's like a place for people to hang out and to meet people. And for the houseware, for the ceramics and stuff, most of the stuff are by the artist. So it's another form of artwork which you could use as well. That's how I see them, rather than just a piece of bone chinaware. There's a story behind it. That's what I like, every single item. The artist, it's called Leanne. She did a lot of watercolor work based on tea parties. So I think it's kind of cute. For example, for the ceramics, they are mainly to illustrate the moment of time, to capture that moment. So I don't think it would be appropriate to have too much color on the artwork because that's artists want to capture the time. And whereas Justin, or the screen printed artwork, he used kind of like a subtle tone because all the events it was happening was kind of sad. And he wanted to capture like there was a hurricane and then there was a fire going on. He's capturing the middle Texas atmosphere. I think that's what he's trying to get. So it's kind of sad. So he's using like kind of pale tone. Whereas Vieira and Paul is more dramatic, happy. It's showing different artists, got different characteristics. I've got two artists from the state, two artists from the UK, and one Hong Kong artist at the moment. I will be having more coming in, but it just takes time to get here. Mainly overseas UK, I would say. I think I've grown into this place a lot. I just decided to move here, and I think it's kind of quiet. It's suitable for what I do. It hasn't got high traffic, but in that way I can meet people who are actually interested in this sort of things rather than just random people. It's another world, basically. It doesn't look like Hong Kong at all. That's what I like. It's the old part of Hong Kong, which preserves its own characteristic. It's not easy. Once I found it, you grow into it, and it's quiet. The locals are friendly. It's more sort of like a local culture in that sense. I would like to run a workshop to promote screen printing or any sort of printmaking, because that's my passion, and I think we should preserve this traditional printing method because it's dying in Hong Kong. Because like we're in the digital world these days, a lot of people moved into digital printing because it's a lot easier. Whereas the lot of artwork I got is screen printed, and it's also woodblock printing, one of the oldest printing method, which you need to carve into the woodblock and then you need to color down and then obviously print it out by hand. Everything is handmade and it's another sort of craft, and if you get it wrong, you have to redo it again. It's not like computer, you could just reprint it. It's not as easy as that.
And that was Femi Chung, founder of Odd One Out, a shop near our Hong Kong bureau, talking of which Aisha Spears is headed there. But for the time being, she's our New York bureau chief. Here's what she hopes happens on her return.
Breaking up is never easy, so I'm going to be upfront. New York, it's over between us, at least for now. In a couple of weeks, I'll be leaving this island of Manhattan for another much warmer one, far away in the South China Sea. From blizzards to blackouts, we've been through a lot over the last 5 years. But the time's come to move to a city where the skyscrapers really do nearly scrape the sky, and where the subway doesn't resemble a rubbish dump. Don't get me wrong, I'll miss you while I'm in Hong Kong. But I'm hoping that by the time I return, you'll have ironed out a few crucial creases in your urban fabric. Here are a few ideas to get you started. The next time I arrive in the city, would it be possible to be welcomed back by a friendly face at immigration? After all, these offices serve as the first taste of American hospitality for many visitors. Instilling a little charm into Team Homeland Security doesn't mean they'll be any less effective at protecting US borders. We can also try to reimagine the immigration hall itself, rather than feeling like a holding pen illuminated by strip lighting and the buzz of a patriotic film, invest some money into making it an airy and modern marvel of American architecture, with the same grandeur and impact as Grand Central or Washington DC's Union Station would have had a century ago. And for some added convenience, why not take a look at Hong Kong's international airport and build a path specifically for frequent travellers to the US to thank them rather than punish them for their regular custom? Once I've collected my luggage, I'd like to avoid the long taxi line, time-consuming traffic, and frequently dubious driving skills of New York cabbies, and instead jump on an express train to Manhattan. It shouldn't take long for an efficient rail service to get me the 15 or so miles into town, and it will be immediately popular with New Yorkers who will love its convenience. Having saved time on getting into the city, it would be great to spend time on other things that New York loves to rush. Let's slow that famous New York minute down a bit. Change the wage system of restaurant workers so that they're paid decently by the hour and not dependent on tips. If they aren't driven to turn over as many tables as possible, that tedious New York trait of receiving the bill before you've asked for it will stop, and we can all relax a little more over our meals. Finally, put the city that never sleeps to bed every now and then. The 24-hour delis, gyms, chemists and food delivery services may offer convenience, but in real terms, they do little for New Yorkers' quality of life. Dear New York, I hope you get some good R&R while I'm gone, and that you'll be a little more fresh-faced when I see you in a year's time. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
All right, thanks, Aisha. That's it for Midori House for today. I want to thank Daniel Giacopelli, our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Edward Lucas, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next is Marcus Hippie's Menu, and then at 2200 hours, Andrew Miller and Emma Nelson will be here with The Daily. I've been Robert Bounds. Thanks for tuning in.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. all add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.